This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Askar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake Him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is His. Who is He that can intercede with Him but by His permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of His knowledge except what He pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires Him not, and He is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
China stamps US President Joe Biden's offer of temporary safe haven to Hong Kong residents in the US, saying the offer violently intervenes in the city's internal affairs. Lockdowns are enforced across Australia's east coast, putting more than 60% of the country's population under strict stay-home orders. Ibrahim Raisi is sworn in as Iran's new president in a ceremony attended by officials from dozens of countries. Joining us. Our top story: China has slammed the US for offering temporary safe haven to Hong Kong residents in the United States. China's foreign ministry branch in Hong Kong accused Washington of, quote, violently intervening in the city's internal affairs. It said the US is trying to badmouth Hong Kong, smear China, and engage in actions to destroy the city's stability and prosperity. On Thursday, President Joe Biden offered safe haven to Hong Kong residents in the U.S., allowing them to extend their stay for 18 months. Washington said the measure is in response to what it called China's crackdown on democracy in Hong Kong. And China has reported its highest daily COVID-19 infections in more than 6 months, as the country is grappling with its worst outbreak since March 2020. Health authorities confirmed 124 new cases in the mainland for the past day, 80 of them locally transmitted. China's current outbreak first started in the eastern Jiangsu province in late June, when the fast-spreading Delta variant broke out there. The cluster of infections has already found its way to over 16 provinces and municipalities, as well as the capital, Beijing. Authorities have intensified efforts to curb the surge. Millions of people are now under lockdowns. Mass testing is also underway in various parts of the country. China has also expanded its vaccination campaign to minors as young as 12. South Korea has extended restrictions as the number of COVID cases keeps surging across the country. Prime Minister there says the existing social distancing curbs will last for 2 more weeks. South Korea imposed the restrictions in mid-July after posting its highest number of daily COVID infections. The curbs were tightened last week ahead of the summer vacations, limiting gatherings across the country. South Korea is struggling to tame its fourth wave of COVID that has seen an average of 1,500 cases a day. The detection of new variants has also added to concerns amid a slow vaccination drive. So far, more than 14% of South Korean population has been vaccinated. More than 60% of Australia's population is under strict lockdowns as the country battles outbreaks fueled by the Delta variant. The lockdowns have been enforced across Australia's east coast. That includes major cities of Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. Residents in these cities are under strict stay-home orders as COVID cases have spiked. Sydney is the worst affected. On Friday, it's reported a record 279 locally acquired cases in 24 hours. That was up from 259 a day earlier, which was a record as well. Meanwhile, Victoria State plunged into its sixth lockdown on Thursday night since the pandemic began. The restrictions in Australia have caused public anger. The government is under fire for a slow vaccination drive. Ibrahim Raisi has been sworn in as the 8th Iranian president. The inauguration ceremony was held in Iran's parliament with the presence of foreign dignitaries and officials from different countries. Our correspondent Yusuf Jalali has more details.
Ibrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, with the prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. With Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ibrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said he will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers. Coming from the Persepolis camp, Ibrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Political commentator Bijan Tavassali says that the inauguration of Iran's Ibrahim Raisi today presents a peaceful transition of power, which is still not seen in many developed countries such as the United States.
What we've seen today, if you ask any scholar of history, has only recently become the norm. It has been an anomaly for like centuries in human history, that you can just witness a peaceful transfer of power. Mm-hmm. And even in many countries today, that is not what voters can expect after an election. Let's remember that just at January 6th in Washington, D.C. in the United States, there were riots and Democrats claimed that Trump supporters want to overthrow the results of the election.
Right.
So even in developed countries like the United States, such a thing that we've seen today, the completely peaceful transfer of power to a new president, is not normal. And so we can celebrate this, and mm-hmm. we can celebrate democracy.
So more than 60% of Australia's population has gone under strict lockdown as the country battles outbreaks of fueled by the Delta variant. To discuss that further, I'm joined by Fran Baum, who is a distinguished professor of public health at Flinders University and the co-chair at the Global Steering Council of the People Health Movement, joining us from Adelaide. Fran, welcome. You know, at the start of this pandemic, Australia was praised by many mainstream media and news outlets for the way that it handled the pandemic. It was praised as a role model. Where did it all go wrong?
Well, I'm not sure it has all gone wrong. I mean, yeah, we did really well last year, and then this year with Delta and the great kind of infectiousness of Delta, we've been caught out. But we've mainly been caught out because I guess our federal government hasn't provided enough vaccines yet. So we only have about 15% of the population who have had both vaccines and about 40% now who have had one. And because Delta is so infectious, that means the Australian population has been very vulnerable. In my state, for instance, because the public health laws differ from state to state, so the state that's suffering the most at the moment is New South Wales, which is where Sydney's located. And today they had nearly 300 cases, which for Australia is a high number.
And Fran, how long do you think Australia can maintain this status quo? Well, you know, I mean, the lockdowns and the restrictions, strict lockdowns, that is.
Yeah, well, I guess what any government's doing is juggling the public health need to protect people by using the lockdown as a measure to deal with the pandemic. But of course, people are always looking at the economics of it. And there is dispute about that. I mean, some people said if you let the virus just run, then it will also be bad for the economy. But a lot of businesses are complaining about the lockdown now. You know, restaurants, many shops, sporting events, and so on. So, and I understand that in Victoria last night there was a protest against the lockdown. The Premier announced the sixth lockdown that they've had in Victoria since the start of the pandemic, and that's the state where Melbourne is based. And there were protests on the street about the lockdown. So I guess it's whether people run out of patience with the public health efforts to defeat the virus.
Okay, Fran, thank you very much indeed for sharing your thoughts. Fran Baum there, political commentator, joining us live out of Adelaide. Now, Japan has marked the 76th anniversary of the world's first atomic bomb attack by the United States during the Second World War. The event was held at the Hiroshima Peace Memorial Park. The city's mayor has called on world leaders to move from nuclear deterrence to confidence-building dialogue. Survivors, relatives, and a handful of foreign dignitaries have attended this year's main event in the city of Hiroshima to pray for the victims and call for world peace. The United States dropped the first bomb on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945, killing around 140,000 people. 3 days later, the U.S. dropped a second atomic bomb on Nagasaki, where 74,000 people were killed.
In the early months of 1945, and despite Germany's official surrender in the Second World War, tensions showed no signs of abating in the Pacific. Washington, which was still seeking to avenge Tokyo's surprise attacks on its naval base of Pearl Harbor, called for an unconditional surrender of Japan. In the Potsdam Conference in Berlin, China and the so-called Big Three, including Joseph Stalin of the Soviet Union, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill, and US President Harry Truman, said the alternative for Tokyo would be nothing but prompt and utter destruction. But Japan's initial refusal led to what is regarded as one of the darkest moments in human history.
At 8:15 in the morning, a 5-ton bomb fell over the city of Hiroshima in southern Japan.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima and destroyed its usefulness to the enemy.
Enola Gay, the United States B-29 Super Fortress bomber, dropped an atomic bomb called the Little Boy on the center of the city. The nuclear payload, however, was anything but little. In the billionth of a second, it brought the temperature up to 10,000 times hotter than the sun's surface, instantly killing 60 to 80,000 people. The intense heat of the explosion destroyed a massive area of more than 10 kilometers in the blink of an eye. A large number of people, unaware of what happened, walked for considerable distances before they collapsed and died. It caused destruction on an unprecedented scale, but the U.S. praised this human tragedy as a scientific triumph of its own.
We have spent more than $2 billion on the greatest scientific gamble in history, and we have won.
3 days later, Japan woke up to another disaster. At 11:02 in the morning, the United States dropped an even bigger bomb on another southern Japanese city. This time, a plutonium implosion type called Fat Man was dropped on the port city of Nagasaki. One third of the city was destroyed. Nearly all the residents in the hypocenter, tens of thousands of innocent men, women, and children were immediately killed by the shockwaves. Only those who were away from home at the time of bombing got a second chance.
6 days after the atomic bombing of Nagasaki, on August the 15th, 1945, grieving Japan agreed to the Allied terms of surrender. Up to this day, the U.S. remains the first and only country to ever use atomic weaponry in wartime. More than seven decades later, many people are still suffering from cancer, impaired growth, intellectual disabilities, and many other long-term effects of the disaster. But Washington is not even willing to make a single apology for its fatal decision. It acts as one of the prominent advocates against even the peaceful nuclear proliferation of many countries, enforcing different types of punitive measures, like economic sanctions. That is why the US itself possesses substantial nuclear weapons and arsenal, and is one of the only five nuclear weapon states recognized in the world.
The Mexican president has defended his country's move to sue several U.S. gun manufacturers over their role in arms trafficking inside the Latin American nation.
It's not going against the amendment that gives Americans the right to bear arms, but the way these weapons are manufactured and sold that reach our country and cause deaths.
Obrador accused the gun makers of making weapons tailored to the needs of Mexican clients who are dedicated to organized crime. Mexico has for long been under pressure from Washington to fight narcotics trafficking inside the U.S. New Mexico is now urging Washington to crack down on weapons flow in the opposite direction. The lawsuit filed on Wednesday demands compensation for the damages caused by the American company's negligent practices. According to official data from the Mexican government, more than 17,000 killings in 2019 alone involved guns smuggled from the United States. Activist and political commentator Nicholas Ayala says American gun manufacturers sell arms to virtually anyone, irrespective of their backgrounds.
The U.S. has simply been going after the symptoms of the disease, whereas now Mexico was really going after the disease itself, which is these for-profit transnational gun manufacturers who really thrive off of both a legal and illegal market of purchasers who are, you know, in committed to crimes like the cartels, or who may simply be terrorists like in Syria or in Iraq or Afghanistan, who are funded and armed and trained by the U.S. military. So in either case, we see that the Mexican state is really going after the root cause of the issue, which is these gun manufacturers and their willingness to do deals with anyone, anywhere.
Wraps up our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels,
and the inhabitants of thy heavens and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Roger Blanford, a Stanford professor of physics and Slack professor of particle physics and astrophysics, said 50 years ago, when astrophysicists started speculating about how the magnetic field might behave close to a black hole, they had no idea that one day we might have the techniques to observe this directly and see Einstein's general theory of relativity in action. We now present you an article written by Dave Makichuk. The piece is titled Black Hole Discovery Backs Einstein's Theory. The article has been published by the Asia Times. another scenario that was predicted by Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity has been confirmed more than a century after it was first posed. And it all began when Stanford University astrophysicist Dan Wilkins noticed an intriguing pattern as he watched X-rays being flung out into the universe by the supermassive black hole at the center of a galaxy 800 million light-years away. According to a report by Taylor Kubota of Stanford News, Wilkins observed a series of bright flares of X-rays, exciting but not unprecedented. These bright light flares are not unusual because although light can't escape a black hole, the enormous gravity around it can heat up material to millions of degrees. This can release radio waves and X-rays. Sometimes this superheated material is hurled out into space by rapid jets, including X-rays and gamma rays. But then the telescope recorded something unexpected and exciting. Additional flashes of X-rays that were smaller, later, and of different colors than the bright flares. According to theory, these luminous echoes were consistent with X-rays reflected from behind a black hole. But even a basic understanding of black holes tells us that that is a strange place for light to come from. Wilkins, who is a research scientist at the Kavli Institute for Particle Astrophysics and Cosmology at Stanford University and SLAC National Accelerator Laboratory, said, "Any light that goes into that black hole doesn't come out, so we shouldn't be able to see anything that's behind the black hole." However, it is another strange characteristic of the black hole that makes this observation possible. And that takes us back to the great physicist himself, who released his theory of general relativity way back in 1905. Albert Einstein predicted that light must bend and reflect due to the strong gravitational pull around a black hole. Wilkins explained, "The reason we can see that is because that black hole is warping space, bending light and twisting magnetic fields around itself." The serendipitous discovery, detailed in a paper published on 28th of July in Nature, is the first direct observation of light from behind a black hole, a scenario that was predicted by Albert Einstein's theory but never confirmed until now. Roger Blandford, a co-author of the paper and a Stanford professor of physics and SLAC professor of particle physics and astrophysics, said, 50 years ago, when astrophysicists started speculating about how the magnetic field might behave close to a black hole, they had no idea that one day we might have the techniques to observe this directly and see Einstein's general theory of relativity in action. Researchers weren't even looking to confirm Einstein's theory. They were originally attempting to uncover the mysteries of an odd feature of black holes known as the corona, the source of the bright X-ray light. Material falling into a supermassive black hole powers the brightest continuous sources of light in the universe, and, as it does so, forms a corona around the black hole. This light, which is X-ray light, can be analyzed to map and characterize a black hole. The leading theory for what a corona is starts with gas sliding into the black hole where it superheats to millions of degrees. At that temperature, electrons separate from the atoms, creating a magnetized plasma. Caught up in the powerful spin of the black hole, the magnetic field arcs so high above the black hole and twirls about itself so much that it eventually breaks altogether. A situation so reminiscent of what happens around our own sun that it borrowed the name corona. Dan Wilkins said, This magnetic field, getting tied up and then snapping close to the black hole, heats everything around it and produces these high-energy electrons that then go on to produce the X-rays. As Dan Wilkins took a closer look to investigate the origin of the flares, he saw a series of smaller flashes. The researchers determined that these are the same X-ray flares but reflected from the back of the disk, a first glimpse at the far side of a black hole. Dan Wilkins said, "I've been building theoretical predictions of how these echoes appear to us for a few years." He added, "I'd already seen them in the theory I've been developing, so once I saw them in the telescope observations, I could figure out the connection." The black hole is about 10 million times more massive than our Sun, and it's located in the center of a nearby spiral galaxy called Aizwiki, 1,800 million light years away from Earth. The observations were made using two space-based X-ray telescopes, NASA's New Star and the European Space Agency's XMM Newton. More observation will be needed to understand these black hole coronas and the European Space Agency's upcoming X-ray observatory called ATHENA, stands for Advanced Telescope for High Energy Astrophysics, will launch in 2031. Dan Wilkins said, "It's got a much bigger mirror than we've ever had on an X-ray telescope, and it's going to let us get higher resolution looks in much shorter observation times." He added, "So the picture we're starting to get from the data at the moment is going to become much clearer with these new observatories." From here, astronomers hope to use the various colors observed as the X-ray echoes travel around the black hole to create a three-dimensional map of the black hole surroundings. They also hope to learn how the corona produces such bright flares.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ministry.
Before I got to know my Lebanon when I returned home as a teenager, I knew the Lebanese poet Gibran Khalil Gibran. Those famous lines from his famous books are often remembered. For instance, "Out of suffering have emerged the strongest souls. The most massive characters are seared with scars." The explosion that shook our city of Beirut a year ago today was something we have never seen in any Hollywood movie. I don't know of it if it's possible to make such a scene in even an animated movie either. I give only one piece of information to explain the horror of the incident. The quivering of this explosion was a 3.5 on the Richter scale. 218 people were killed in the blast of Beirut, a few of whom were on ground zero at the time of the explosion were never found. More than 7,000 were injured, and more than 300,000 people became instantly homeless. People from around the world expressed their sorrow at the suddenness of the incident, but the first punch was thrown by former U.S. President Donald Trump. In a briefing at the White House shortly after the incident, he claimed that the explosion was a massive bomb attack. This raised a whole lot of questions for everyone as to who might have done it, how, and most importantly, why. On the other hand, the Lebanese government claimed since the beginning of the incident that more than 2,700 tons of ammonium nitrate were stored in the warehouse where the incident took place at the seaport. This made every one of us wonder why this huge amount of ammonium has been stored in a densely populated area since 2014. The fact so far is that the ammonium was recovered from a ship brought in illegally and stored in a warehouse at the seaport since 2014, and a whole lot of officials knew about it, including heads of state, prime ministers, and even, or rather mainly, the commander-in-chief of the Lebanese armed forces. The atrocity encapsulated everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system: the rampant corruption, the incompetent inaction, a system held hostage by a foreign power whose potence to be Lebanese defenders has shattered this nation many times over. And last but not least, our eternal enemy, Israel, that benefited from every atrocity that had ever fallen upon my people, whether they had a hand in it or not. The lesson of the August 4 atrocity is that accepting that the U.S.-French imposed regime means accepting leaders who think nothing of murdering their own citizens. If we allow Lebanon to continue fragmenting, it opens the door to catastrophes of an infinitely greater magnitude than the fourth explosion. This disaster must be our wake-up call for inaugurating a new Lebanon. There's no salvation for a system that is rotten to the core, pushed by Western colonial powers. Our salvation is through collectively banishing those who colluded in Lebanon's downfall and who remain wedded to a medieval and inherently corrupt sectarian system. About 100 years ago, in 1923, Gibran wrote in The Prophet, "You need to know the secret of death. How can you know the secret if you do not know life?" But today, Gibran's Beirut does not know the secret of death as we struggle to decipher the meaning of our lives on this beautiful yet battered piece of land. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. A year after the explosion that rocked Beirut on August 4th, 2020, killing 218 people, injuring more than 7,000, and devastating much of the city, the Lebanese investigation into the blast has yielded no credible results. Families of the victims, some of whom are calling for an international investigation, are sadly being beaten by riot police a year after the tragedy for simply demanding the truth about what killed their kids, their mothers, their fathers, their loved ones. A year after the explosion, none of the victims' families in Lebanon have been asked to give witness statements, nor have they received any form of official apology or even been contacted by Lebanese authorities. Families of the victims and every Lebanese citizen wants answers to their many questions. They want to know why the ammonium nitrate was in the port, who ordered it, and what's happened to the rest of it since just 750 tons out of the 2,750 stored there reportedly exploded. Just imagine what would have happened to Beirut and its greater surrounding areas had the 2,750 tons exploded. I can't imagine. We want to know if there were other explosives kept in that port and how the fire that triggered the explosion was started, and whether it was really just a fire or was it an act of terrorism. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is member of the Lebanese Parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc Hezbollah. Thank you very much, Dr. Moussaoui, for being with us. A year on after the largest non-nuclear explosion in history, how do you set the scene post-blast, pandemic-ridden, financially beaten Lebanon?
Well, this is, first of all, thank you for having me on the show.
Pleasure.
What we're about actually to talk about now, we're talking about one of the worst catastrophes ever. We're talking here about a disaster that was man-made, it's whether it's negligence, whether it's in purpose, whatever the reason is. All of this time that has passed, we're about like two days from now, and we're going to have the first anniversary for this tragedy that happened in Lebanon. We've been waiting, and we continue to wait for the judiciary to come out and to give the victims some tribute, to give their families some answers for the very important questions about what happened. We're not telling them to tell us about the secret issues, the secret side of the investigation. We know very well, and we believe in the secrecy of the investigation. It should be kept. It should be classified for one reason or another, because we wanted justice. Justice is what we seek. But still now there are things that can be told to the people, to the public opinion, to all the Lebanese parties, to all the Lebanese factions, to the international community. And if you know, and we know that for a fact, that the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, has come two times, and he has sought this. He has said that we want the judiciary to come and tell us, the one who is taking the responsibility of the investigation, to come and tell us about the general lines of what happened, general lines of how did this explosion happen. Because you know very well that Hezbollah is being accused by certain parties, and they are investing.
We will talk about that extensively, but Dr. Mousawi, 218 people died in the Beirut explosion, yet the survivors have been abandoned for slow, torturous deaths, or maybe sickness from hunger, from poverty, from lack of medicine, and from the political turmoil that is possibly yet to come to the country. What has Hezbollah done so far within its jurisdiction as part of the government and as part of the Lebanese parliament as well to ensure justice is to be served at least to the survivors?
Actually, one very important issue, we are not, there is a government and there is a statesmanship. There is a state that should handle the whole matter. You are exactly right. We are part of the government. We are part of the parliament, and we should be responsible one way or another in order to make sure, ensure that justice is going to take its place. To tell you the truth, I am in the Committee of Justice and Administration in the Lebanese parliament, and we have gone through this issue deeply. We have brought opinions, legal opinions from judges, from authorities, some people who have authority over such issues, and they themselves said when we got this appeal from the judiciary that they want the parliamentarians or some MPs who were ministers at the time to come and appear before the court, we have tried as much as we can in order to take a legal decision. No legal conclusion has come to us that the parliament has any evidence or has any premises where they can build upon to present those to the judiciary. That's why the Lebanese parliament has taken the initiative to direct accusations, and in order to later on present a committee that is going to be composed of eight judges from the Lebanese judiciary, seven MPs from the Lebanese parliament, and they are going to go into deep investigation for those who are accused of negligence or of whatever.
Why did it take so much time? It's been a year.
Yeah, it's been a year because, to tell you the truth, there has been a problem. You know what happened. There was one judge, and then he was replaced by another,
yes.
And they were like looking into the different evidences.
Definitely.
Or whatever.
Why?
That
brings
are there.
Us to summarizing what's happening right now against Hezbollah, to be specific. Now, the atrocity summarized everything that is rotten about Lebanon's governing system, the corruption, the incompetent inaction, and the politicized judiciary system, which explains why it went to one judge and then to the other. Yet a large group of NGOs that were born directly after that explosion, who are funded by Western powers, are propagating that Hezbollah is behind the blast, and that the regime is being held, and I quote, hostage by Hezbollah. Could you please tell us, in what sectors are you guys holding the Lebanese regime hostage, if you don't mind me asking?
Well, this is I mean, this is a joke, but no one likes such jokes, actually. When we talk about political things, when we talk about a country that is engulfed in such a huge problems, those people who are doing this, they are trying to mislead the public. They are trying to mislead the whole people in Lebanon and outside, because they are actually covering the face of the true criminal, and they are trying to pinpoint to others who are not responsible. Actually, we have nothing whatsoever to do with what happened. We know this is a political agenda that has been trying to be put into effect through military actions, military operations, military aggressions. We remember this. I mean, this is for all of the public. We should understand that they are trying to get rid of the resistance one way or another. They started and continued this kind of military aggressions by Israel. It didn't work. Then they have the Takfiri groups. It didn't work. Then they came to this issue.
And this is the second time a political accusation has been made against Hezbollah. And I want to talk more about this, Dr. Ibrahim, but we want to go to the second segment where we dive in into the accusations and what can be done to bring justice to people. Please stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Sure, knowing the truth will not bring our victims back. It will not heal out my youngest child, who still jumps in fear anytime there is a thunderstorm, although her face healed. And she now laughs about it, and she says it's a clown nose once she sees it in photographs. She stayed with the clown nose for weeks, and now she calls it the Big Bang. And when Lebanon's ruling elite pay for what they did, maybe we can have a change here in Lebanon and we can live it in a normal country. Lebanese authorities initially promised a swift investigation into the blast, vowing to deliver results within 5 days. Yes, 5 days. But over the past 12 months, the investigation into the biggest crime in Lebanon's history has been marked by little more than obstruction, evasion, and delay. Lebanon running out of political and economic chances in this following report.
On August 4th, 2020, a devastating blast in a warehouse destroyed much of the center of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Many neighborhoods were destroyed. Downtown Beirut looked like a war zone. Thousands were injured and some 218 people tragically lost their lives on that day and the days that followed. For many, their property and livelihoods were literally blown away. The effects of those explosions are still reverberating 1 year later. The country is striving to find a path to emerge from a tragedy that has touched every single person. The destructive fallout of August 4th intensified suffering in Lebanon, which was already reeling from civil unrest, economic and financial hardship, increasing poverty and unemployment, compounded by political deadlock and a soaring number of COVID-19 cases. A year on from this tragedy, there is deepening hardships and mounting frustration. It is clear that the situation of ordinary people in Lebanon is worsening by the day. Currently, the UN estimates that more than 1 million Lebanese out of a population of almost 8 million, including more than 2 million refugees and migrants, need relief assistance to cover their basic needs, including access to food, health, education, and water. Lebanon, which not so long ago was a high middle-income country, is now facing probably the worst financial and economic crisis in its modern history. Over half of its population is living in poverty. It is perhaps not surprising that many people have lost trust in their leaders and institutions. It is regretful that Lebanon's leaders have been unable to reach agreement on the formation of a new government in the past 12 months, which has delayed urgently needed structural reforms to address the country's numerous challenges. This is a critical moment in Lebanon's history. The combined magnitude, depth, and multidimensionality of the political, socioeconomic, and humanitarian crisis facing Lebanon is unprecedented and presents an increasingly challenging landscape for people who still believe that change is possible. Much of the devastation from the blast is still visible. The port resembles a bomb site, and many buildings have been left in a state of collapse. Major questions remain unanswered, including why such a large shipment of ammonium nitrate, a highly explosive chemical used in bombs and fertilizer, was left stored in the middle of a crowded city for years after unloading in 2014. The immunity enjoyed by senior officials has raised suspicions among some families that there may never be accountability. But ultimately, the responsibility for avoiding the total collapse of Lebanon lies primarily in the hands of its leaders, who so far have shown no intention to truly relieve the suffering of the Lebanese population.
Now we continue with member of the Lebanese parliament, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui from the Loyalty to the Resistance bloc, Hezbollah. Thanks again, Dr. Ibrahim. Now, days ago, it was published in the media by Reuters, to be specific, that the FBI concluded after the blast that the amount of ammonium nitrate that blew up in Beirut port last year was 1/5 of the shipment unloaded there in 2014, adding to suspicions that much of the cargo has actually gone missing. Now, legally speaking, who is responsible for the whereabouts of such a shipment, and where on earth is the remaining part of the ammonium nitrate?
Well, this is a very excellent question. Actually, first, I mean, this tragic event that happened, again, now we are 2 days from now, it will be the first anniversary. The answers are still being sought from the state, from the official side, from the judiciary. If you want exactly who's responsible, here we're talking about who's responsible for the port, for the Beirut port, for the cargo that are there. It's well known, officially, it's the Lebanese army. The Lebanese army is the one who's responsible for the cargo. It's not the general security, because, I mean, it's only responsible for the individuals, not for the cargo or for the goods or whatever.
The other one,
it's the judiciary, because I'm talking generally, this is in general. But if you go, when the judiciary, when this was reported to the judiciary, the judge, there's a judge who has taken a decision to confiscate this or to put it somewhere with all the reservations to be reserved, the official reservation on it. He is the one responsible, actually, and this has been said, actually, that when it is in the hands of the judiciary, because of the principle of the separation of powers, no one has the right to go and interfere in the work and the action and the function of the judiciary. So here we're talking about the judiciary system that is responsible, and the judge who has taken a decision to put them aside and to, like, have investigation over them.
Why wasn't he brought in to at least ask him a couple of questions?
This is one of the problems, actually. Why? We have always called for the, if you want, for the sovereignty of the, and the sovereignty and the independence of judiciary in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. And it has to do with the individuals themselves. To tell you, if you put the best system, if you write the best law, you need someone to put it into effect. Who do put it into effect? The people, the individuals. So when we talk about the individuals and the people, we are talking about judges. This judge who is responsible, he has not been summoned to be listened to or to hear him. There was no session of hearing. There was nothing. And actually, this is why the Lebanese parliament did not accept, actually, because you did not even do anything about this judge or other one responsible.
Well, this is what I want to ask you about. A probe into the port blast led by Judge Tariq Bitar has been hindered over the past month as requests sent to parliament and to government, the one that you're talking about, to lift immunity and enable questioning of several top officials. These demands were either declined or they were stalled. Was it stalled or declined? And what is Hezbollah's stance on this, given that
we did see
signatures of MPs, and we need just to understand why.
Well, to tell you, I'm because I am a member of Justice and Administration Committee, I put my signature also on this list, actually, in order to make a list of accusation against the accused or those who thought of people, ministers or whatever. Why did we do that? Because when we got this appeal from Judge Bitar, we sent him a message. We held a meeting. This is the legal way. This is the legal way to do it, actually. Mm-hmm. We brought all of the parliamentary committees in the parliament. We're talking about the Administration and Justice Committee, and we are talking, when you talk about Administration and Justice Committee, all of the Lebanese parties are represented in this. They are presented, and they are represented there. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about all the parliamentary blocks, they were there. When we started to discuss it, and when we heard those who are accused, there was nothing in the appeal. If you want someone to come to you as a judiciary, you should have brought, I'm not talking about evidences, you should bring some premises, something significant to convince us to not lift, as they say, the immunity. It's not a matter of lifting the immunity. What we have in the parliament is that when we have high treason by the ministers or by the president of the republic, we have the right to form a parliamentary committee, or we have the right to make this accusation. Actually, the Judge Bitar himself did not support, he did not supply us with anything in order to put this into effect. And we sent him a message.
So how
asking,
come they asked to the
we sent him. We sent him a message again, and we told him, if you have anything, when we discussed this on the legal side, and all the parliamentary blocks, they were there, and they all accepted what we said, actually.
Then why was Hezbollah specifically targeted?
Because this is the important question. This tells you that this is the agenda. This is the agenda. This is what they wanted to do. We have been targeted because there is a hidden agenda to all of this. They want to accuse the party of different things because they want to mount the pressure from now till the coming elections, and they want to make this kind of wedge between the people and Hezbollah.
So it's purely a legal matter. But
it is purely illegal. It's purely political.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm talking the lifting the immunity. It's a legal matter that needs evidence. That's why you did not allow.
Absolutely, I'll tell you what. You know what happened when the judge wanted? They put it into the media. You know,
mm-hmm.
instead of sending it to the accused, to the ministers, to the parliamentarians, whoever they are, they heard it from the news. And you know, this is the public opinion, as we say. This is a kind of propaganda, mm-hmm. public opinion. You are mobilizing the people against those persons without giving them the opportunity.
They are changing from illegal into a political propaganda.
Exactly.
But Lebanon is at a very decisive
And to tell you the truth, we have asked the judge, please resend us anything that could allow us, and we are ready to make a meeting mm-hmm. at any time in order to lift the immunity, as you said. Mm-hmm. But
well,
he didn't provide
so
us with anything tangible.
So it's now basically in the hands of Judge Bitar and what happens next. But Lebanon is at a decisive crossroad now with Najib Miqati being the new prime minister designate instead of Saad al-Hariri. And people are criticizing his name, especially that Miqati has a responsibility to uphold since he was prime minister when the ammonium nitrate entered the Beirut port. And he knows about that. What will Miqati be able to achieve here that Hariri was not? And what is your main concern as Hezbollah for the upcoming political and security reality in Lebanon? We have seen over the past couple of days a huge dive in security.
I'm not in a position to defend Prime Minister designate Miqati or to attack someone else. It's only that we have a way in order to come out of this problem. What is the way? The only way is to have to form a government. Now, who was nominated to this position? You know, when we talk about Lebanon, we talk about the priorities. We have a political system who come into a deadlock. We have a structural deficit. We have structural disorder in the political system itself. Now we are, as just like what you said, in a decisive, very sensitive, very crucial position on the economic level, in the political level, on every level. Now, Saad al-Hariri, who was not successful to form the cabinet, he named in the name of the Sunni majority. Let's accept it. We live in a confessional system. Mm-hmm. He named Miqati to this position, and that's why we accepted this, and we have nominated him. We have named him. Why did we do that? Because this is the only way to try to make an attempt to come out of the stalemate of the problem of the crisis.
So hopefully we look forward into forming a government soon enough to try and lift the country from the political and economic challenges.
We don't say that we don't have problems. We don't say we don't have problems. We don't say that there are no flaws or mistakes, but this is the way that would lead us out, and hopefully we can do it.
Inshallah. Thank you very much, Dr. Ibrahim Moussaoui, Lebanese Member of Parliament, part of the Loyalty to the Resistance Bloc, Hezbollah. Thank you very much for being with us. And thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream.
In the limelight.
An analysis by British academics published by the UK government's official scientific advisory group says that they believe it is